And welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your new favorite World War II podcast. And yes, friends, I know we've been away for a while. We had to go through a little reorganization. We had to find a new host. But all that stuff's been taken care of. A little personal news, just because I like to be up front with everybody. We had some great interviews scheduled about 2 weeks ago, but due to some family tragedy in my family and the loss of two family members within a week, I had to take some time away and reschedule. But we're back to it. We're going to try to line up some new shows, bring you a little bit new format, and try to bring you the show we feel you deserve. Before we get on with things tonight, I want to recommend to everybody a Netflix show that you may have seen or may not even be aware of, but it's a very cool concept. It is called Churchill Secret Agents, The New Recruits. And basically what they do is they get some British officers and historians, they get authentic era correct uniforms and training, and they recreate the OSS training facilities and training program that originated in 1942, and they get modern-day volunteers, if you will. They draft modern-day people, and they actually put them through the same rigorous training, psychological training, actually from the book of training from the OSS, obviously with some of the more dangerous physical obstacle courses. They have modern-day safety gear intact, but it's a very cool show. You can actually see what the OSS operatives did as far as training goes, the psychological profiles they had to go through. It's a very cool show. It's only a few episodes long. Check it out. It's on Netflix. Churchill Secret Agents, The New Recruits. Highly recommend it. And previously, I referred to the hosting change. Most of you, I believe, found us on iTunes Podcast, which you can still find us. The easiest way to find us is type in WTSP in the search engine on your Apple iTunes. We are still on the Stitcher app. You can find us on the Stitcher app. The easiest way to find everything about us is through d-410.com. And of course, what's the scuttlebutt.com. Now, I've never mentioned this in the past, but I believe it's very important to bring up to everybody due to the fact that What's the Scuttlebutt is a very popular name. The website whatsthescuttlebutt.com with T's in it has been taken. That's right, it was taken. And I failed to mention in the past that our website whatsthescuttlebutt.com is not spelled exactly correctly. It's scuttle with D's, two D's instead of T's. So it's what's the scuddlebutt.com. Easiest way to find it, though, is go through d-410.com. And if you're an iTunes listener, please give us a rating and a review. That would be fantastic. And a little Hollywood news update for those of you living over on the other side of the pond who are reenactors. U.S. Army D-Day Rangers and Weimar reenactors are being sought out by U.S. film producer Hugh Daly to take part in his hit TV show Legendary Locations. The Hollywood-based producer needs a number of Rangers in full kit, complete with dummy weapons, as well as Weimar soldiers who will be available for filming at the Maisy Battery site in Normandy, France on October 18th. Producer Hugh Daly stated each man will need to have a full uniform and his own personal equipment, plus a deactivated or airsoft non-firing period correct weapon, and of course, our filming requires age-appropriate soldiers. So unfortunately for old guys like me in their 40s, we're not available for this gig. So anyone interested in taking part is requested to send a photograph of themselves in uniform to Hugh Daly at truebrit61@icloud.com. stating their name, age, phone number, and a producer or director will then contact the most suitable candidates to discuss their roles in more detail. The filming at Maisy comes off the back of a brand new two-volume book detailing the role of the U.S. Army Rangers in 1944. The book titled Cover Up at Point du Hoc, a Pen and Sword publishing, has been described by senior military lecturers as the most accurate account of D-Day Rangers ever written, and it is due for release in November 2018. So if you want to possibly get an active role in this upcoming production, get that information sent out. I would do it if I was, well, one, not 40, and two, lived over in Europe. Once again, send your information to truebrit61@icloud.com, stating your name, age, and phone number, and they will get back to you. And joining us on the phone for this week's episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, it's author Clay Bonnyman Evans, and he's here to promote his book, Bones of My Grandfather, the story of his grandfather, 1st Lieutenant Alexander Sandy Bonnyman Jr. Mr. Evans, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm not doing too bad. this is actually the my comeback show, if you will. We've put together 29 episodes since January. We do about one a week. Our original goal was to try to find as many World War II vets as we can, but as you know, they're getting harder and harder to find. And so the show kind of spun off more into World War II reenacting, as well as all things World War II. We try to interview as many authors, producers, anyone with any interest of getting the history of World War II out there. And I'm super excited to have you join us tonight. First things first, let's get a little background history on you, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, I, you know, I grew up, was born and raised in Colorado and spent most of my life in the Rocky Mountains, you know, Wyoming, New Mexico, places like that. I have been a journalist for a lot of my life. I've also done some sort of PR work and things like that. And I'm now a freelance writer, and I've published four books. This most recent book, which is about my grandfather, Alexander Bonnieman, or Sandy as he was known, really has, you know, almost consumed my life in the very best possible way since about 2010, when I really sort of plunged headlong into the subject matter of this book.
Well, the first thing, you kind of answered one of my first questions, which was reading this book, I love the way you laid it out. The reading is super compelling. It's very easy to follow along with, but I love the fact that you kind of switch back and forth. You lay out your grandfather's early childhood history in one chapter. The next chapter, you'll start off in his military history, you know, how he, you know, his enlistment in the military. Then the next chapter, you'll kind of switch to how you got started in the recovery of going down to Tarawa and trying to help locate his remains. And then the next chapter, you'll go back to more of his childhood and his teenage years. And so even though it bounces around, it's very easy to follow, and it's a nice way to get all the information across in a very concise, conducive way. And it's really a really fantastic read. And I love that. And, you know, before you came on and said you have multiple other books in journalism, I was going to compliment you on the great style of writing that you did on this book. And now that I know that you have, you know, years of journalism and other books underneath your belt, it makes a lot more sense on how great this book is when it comes to the layout and the reading of it.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate the compliment. You know, yeah, it helps that I've been paid to be a writer for, you know, 30 or more years, really, or close to 30 years, I guess it is. And honestly, it's interesting that you bring up that sort of structure. This book is the story of my grandfather. And what I tell people is it's sort of about my grandfather in body, mind, and spirit. And what I mean by that is that, you know, my grandfather was the great hero of our family. He received the Medal of Honor posthumously after he was killed in the Battle of Tarawa on November 22nd, 1943. My mother, who's still living in Colorado, was his oldest child, and so she was the one who actually received that medal. And what that meant was, for me as a little boy and growing up, you know, my whole life, that Medal of Honor was hanging on the wall, and I just, you know, I really admired my grandfather, and I looked at that medal, and we had a great portrait that was done of him posthumously. And so, you know, I knew the outlines of his story, but really our whole family kind of was content to leave it there, outlines. And what happened in 2010, really 2009, late 2009, I had always been told by my mother that my grandfather's remains were buried in the punch bowl on Oahu in Hawaii. And in 2009, her younger sister sent me an email that set me down a trail of kind of investigation. And I learned that, in fact, he probably had not been taken back to Hawaii and was still buried on this teeny tiny little island in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific. So really starting with that, I got very intrigued You know, I won't go into all the details, but I got involved with an effort to find not only his remains, but those of hundreds of other Marines on this teeny little island. And the book, to get back to what you were saying about the structure, it really does go back and forth in time, because as this effort was ongoing to recover his remains, unbury him, if you will, in his physical remains, I undertook the effort to unbury his, if you will, his spiritual remains, his life story that had really been lost even to my own family. So the book goes back and forth in time, telling the story of my grandfather and the story of this contemporary effort. And it's very important that I mention this. This effort is due almost entirely to the work and the persistence of a man named Mark Noah, who started a nonprofit called History Flight. And that is the organization that I decided to hitch my cart to, and was very, very fortunate to be part of the effort to recover my grandfather in 2015.
Well, I think a lot of my listeners may be somewhat familiar with this gentleman through the documentary series, The Return to Tarawa. He had a few scenes in that outlaying his research and his maps. But I kind of want to get to that here in a minute. But what I wanted to ask you, you brought up that you kind of got into this in around 2009, but reading the book and reading some of the interviews that you did with some of the gentlemen who fought alongside your grandfather, a few of them in particular that made references to past letters that they had written to your grandmother. By the time 2009 rolled around, had your family, and particularly the elders in your family, have they kind of been, I don't want to say tiresome, but kind of just off-put from the constant, because I'm sure every time an interview, a book, a magazine, a movie, a comic strip from 1947 to 2009, I'm sure they're constantly getting inundated with questions. As you alluded to in the book, they got different accounts of what happened to your grandfather. Sometimes they got two or three accounts from the same eyewitness who was going back and, you know, revisiting his own memories. Was it kind of, when you got involved in 2009, was some of your other family members just, for lack of a better phrase, kind of over it?
I don't know that they were over it. I mean, the truth is, we just were very content in general to let the broad outlines of this story stand, which was, we knew he had, you know, the very, very general outlines of how he lived his life, and that he had gone off to join the Marine Corps at age 31. He was a father, a husband. He owned a business that was critical to the war effort. He didn't have to go. Mm-hmm. And yet he did. And he chose to go. He was from a very prominent, wealthy family. He could have certainly gotten into the Army or Navy, you know, an officer's program, but he didn't want to do that. I tell people, I think my grandfather was ADD. He didn't like sitting still. He didn't like sitting at a desk. He didn't like wearing a tie. And when it came to World War II, he wanted to be in on the action. So he joined the Marines at age 31. He was actually 32 by the time he got to boot camp. But the guys around him were 18, 19, 17, 20 years old. So he was the old man. So we knew these things generally, but we didn't know a lot. And the older generation had all died. His younger brother, much younger brother, had died in 2004. And my mother and her younger sister, my auntie, who lives in Hawaii, they just didn't know very much. So the truth is, our family had been pretty content to just kind of have these vague outlines. And I, being a journalist and being a kind of obsessive person, I said, I got to know as much about this guy as I possibly can. And you mentioned letters and so forth. And I just have to say, I am extremely fortunate. I'm a journalist. I know how to do research. I'm fortunate to have the connection to this man. And I'm fortunate to have a family that not only wrote a lot of letters, but they saved everything. And so when I really got going on this, I just contacted family members and I said, hey, take a look in your basement, see if you've got anything that might be of interest, and I would be really grateful if you'd pass it along. And I got to tell you, I found amazing stuff. My mother was not an organized person, but I started going through her stuff, finding amazing things, and then getting just astonishing treasure troves of letters from that time, from World War II and after, from a number of different relatives. So I was incredibly fortunate. And this book is based very, very heavily on those letters and military documents and so forth. I counted them up recently. I think there's almost 500 footnotes in this book. That's how well researched, you know, that's how much priority I put on research and finding those things to really support what I was writing about.
Absolutely. And I want to back up just a little bit, because you mentioned something that I think really underscores the character of your grandfather. When you said he had a successful business that contribute to the war effort, he did, and it was at that time very profitable. But I want the listeners to understand, no, he did not go and join a officer's training program. He enlisted as a private in the United States Marine Corps. I mean, at 32, yep, because he didn't have the college degree, and he didn't have all the other requirements that the Marine Corps required for officer training school. And so his only option to fulfill his desire to fight for his country was to enlist as a private in the United States Marine Corps and leave his family behind, because not only did he have a business, but he had a wife and three children.
That's right, three daughters. Yeah, that's right. Well, he didn't qualify because you had to be no older than 27, and you weren't supposed to be married. And the exceptions they made were people with a college degree and so forth. And my grandfather had attended Princeton, played football there. But again, as I say, he wasn't a guy who liked sitting at a desk, and he didn't want to stay in college. He left. He got kicked out, to tell you the truth. And he went out and sort of found a life of adventure, which is what he really wanted. So he was a buck private, and he went in knowing he was going to be a buck private. And, you know, fortunately, in training in San Diego, his natural leadership abilities became very apparent to his superior officers, particularly a colonel, highly unusual. My grandfather was at that time had been made a corporal, and his best buddy was a colonel.
Yep.
And he socialized with him. And Colonel Gilder Jackson recognized his leadership potential. He said, listen, I know you think you want to be a grunt and go with these guys, and that's fine, but I'm going to file the paperwork because I don't want to waste your leadership ability. And thankfully, Colonel Jackson did that, because that actually paved the way. When my grandfather got overseas, he continued to perform to a high degree of excellence. He went overseas in October 42. By January 43, he had been made a second lieutenant. And a couple months before he was killed in the Battle of Tarawa, he had been promoted to first lieutenant. So that's pretty impressive. It was about 14 months from buck private to first lieutenant. And we can thank, in part, Colonel Jackson for that.
And it's because of his business running mining operations and his knowledge of heavy equipment, the physics of digging
and explosives
yep. that got him, which the Marine Corps is very good at figuring out what you're good at, and I don't want to say exploiting that, but using that to their benefit, that they put him in an engineering battalion.
Yep. They wanted to take advantage of that background he had. He had worked for his father's coal mining company, as well as gotten some jobs, you know, to learn demolitions and so forth that were, after he left Princeton, you know, down in Virginia, he got the ropes. He learned the ropes of that. And that's the kind of thing he liked doing. He liked doing physical things. So he was, he had demolition expertise, and that is why they put him in, as he put it, his old business, and put him with an engineering battalion, the Pioneer Battalion. He shipped over with a different unit, but he wound up with 218, 2nd Battalion, 18th Marines. which was attached to 2-8 for the Battle of Tarawa, and that was a Pioneer Engineering Battalion.
And before he landed on Tarawa, he did spend some time on Guadalcanal at the end of that campaign, helping to build the infrastructure that would be later used for the stationing of Marines and Army and Naval and Army Air Corps personnel throughout the war. So before he even went to Tarawa, he did spend some time on Guadalcanal and had some minor engagements there with the enemy, which kind of made him realize what it was all about. And I guess, obviously, between Guadalcanal and Tarawa, they had some time in New Zealand, in which he kind of looked back on that engagement in Guadalcanal and just kind of, because boredom is the death of morale when it comes to the Marines in any sort of hurry-up-and-wait situation. And when you're sitting in New Zealand for 9 months, there's only so much you can do to occupy your time. And so when they found out they were shipping out, he was kind of raring to go.
He certainly was. Well, as you know, the 1st Marine Division really was, had fought at Guadalcanal from August 1942. And then the 2nd Marine Division came in to help mop up. And because my grandfather was the second lieutenant at that time, he was with that engineering unit, he was put in charge with rebuilding a bridge over what was called the Toha River. And during that, while he was there, he was only there for about a month or so, he actually experienced his first combat, and his unit clashed with a Japanese patrol. And he was glad to get that combat. He was pleased to find the action. And he had to go back to New Zealand, as you say. They were there for a really long time. They were training. They were doing this and that. And it was hard on him. He was raring to go. He was itching to go. He'd gotten that taste of combat. And as he wrote his wife, my grandmother, the 1st Marine Division had really set an example, in taking Guadalcanal in four or five months of really, really tough fighting. He wanted to put his mark on that war. And he got his opportunity, finally, in November of 1943, when he and the rest of the Marines of the 2nd Division sailed for the Solomon Islands, where they did some amphibious assault training, and then went off to Tarawa. They didn't even know where they were going until they were underway. So it was quite a big secret.
And back to his combat that he faced on Guadalcanal, not to give too much away, because I really want people to go out and buy Bones of My Grandfather, not to give away the story, but there are some stories you tell from his childhood where your grandfather wasn't known to back down from a fight. So, it doesn't surprise me that once he engaged in his first combat action, that it really kind of got his fluids going, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Well, like I say, the way I think of him is he was just a man of action. He was, depending on who you talk to, he was a daredevil or he was reckless. He was impetuous or he was courageous. But the fact of the matter is he was a guy who liked to test himself. He was what we would call an adrenaline junkie today. There's a little story I tell in the book about how he used to freak everybody out because there was a cement swimming pool at his parents' house in Knoxville, Tennessee. And from the time he was a boy until he was, a grown man, he used to love to run up the roof of the bathhouse and just hurl himself about 12, 15 feet across the cement into the water and just terrify his parents and everybody who was watching. He was a guy who did not back down from a fight. He liked to have a drink. And when he got going, he enjoyed that kind of thing. So he also, it's worth probably pointing out, he didn't turn out to have the skills to make the grade, but all the way back in 1932, looking for adventure, he joined the U.S. Army Air Corps because he had hoped to become a pilot. So he did train down in San Antonio and ultimately was found not to be what they were looking for, but he received an honorable discharge with an evaluation of excellent character. So that was many years before he joined the Marine Corps.
And that was something else I wanted to compliment you on, reading this book. And I kind of know from personal experience, because prior to podcasting, I also did terrestrial radio for 5.5 years. And there was times when I told stories about my family, and when I first got into it, you're reluctant about saying something that someone from the outside world may be as disparaging, and so you sort of censor yourself at first, which impacts your ability to tell a story, whereas over time you get over that. One of the things I want to compliment you on is your honesty about your family members, not only your grandfather, but maybe your grandmother and a few other family members. There are certain stories or things in this book that as a reader, you sit back and say, okay, this guy is being honest with us because he's saying some things that maybe some of us would kind of, I don't want to say modify, but maybe not be so open with about when it comes to the character of certain personnel and their family. But your honesty when it comes to telling these stories makes me, the reader, believe that you're not trying to prop your grandfather up to be something that he wasn't. You actually lay out all the conflicting stories about his death and what some people say and other things. And that honesty came through, and I really want to compliment you on that because it is not easy to openly, you know, be honest about your family. And I just hope you take great pride in that.
Well, thanks. It was actually, like I say, I'm a journalist, so my training was all you follow the reporting where it goes and you report what you find. You don't censor, you don't try to shape what you're writing to. Your job is to do the reporting and report what you find, and that's what I vowed to do. And, you know, I just heard a quote today on a podcast, actually it was from a book I was listening to, and it's an old saying, I can't tell you who said it, but the line between good and bad runs through every human heart. And my grandfather's nephew, who is a cousin of my mother's and mine, he's 85, he's a Catholic deacon. You know, he said, I don't remember whether I quoted him in the book, but he was like, look, we all fall short. And I wanted to just tell the truth about my grandfather the way that I would try to tell the truth about myself. Because here's the thing. It's easy to take somebody who's done something heroic as my grandfather did, and history tends to whitewash these people. Or we even now make movies about people and we just portray them as almost demigods. Well, guess what? We're not. We're human beings. And to me, my grandfather was an incredibly admirable person with unbelievable assets. And he was complicated, like all of us. That's more interesting to me because it's more true. It's more real. Then if we've got a story, and I won't mention the book, but it drives me crazy. It was a big bestseller that portrayed a guy as almost like superhuman. And none of us are superhuman. And my grandfather had incredible assets, and he used those assets, especially on that day that he died. It was very, very much in keeping with his character, what he did to receive that Medal of Honor. I just think it's a much better, truer, more human story, knowing that he was a real man, like you or me or anybody. He had his flaws. He had his quirk. That's a better story than if we whitewash it, I think.
And that's the nice thing about the chapter where you start talking about the multiple different stories about how his demise came. You took your journalistic spirit and you took that clarity and you actually said, hey, some of these stories I've read, to me and to other people, it seems like there's a lot of artistic licensing taken, and it almost got to a comic book or movie-esque level, and you did your damnedest to try to separate the truth from the embellishment in an effort to try to at least try to provide as much clarity and evidence of what really happened on that day, because there are so many conflicting stories. And so that was a nice aspect of it, too. And I just want to ask you, once again, this is a great book. It's Bones of My Grandfather, and I don't want to give too much away, but do you feel by the end of this book that you found the closest to the truth of how your grandfather died on that day?
Boy, I really do. I mean, I you know, like you say, there are versions that got sort of passed along over the years or put into a comic strip literally that overstated certain things. And then there were some versions that really undermined, you know, what he had done. And here I am, you know, decades and decades later reading all this stuff and saying, well, what's the truth? I wasn't there. I'm never going to be there. There is, shockingly, some film of the beginning of the assault in which he was killed. There's film you can see online that captured my grandfather probably within a minute or two of his death. We don't get his death on camera, but so there's all kinds of stuff for me to go through. Here's the amazing thing. You know, I got all the documents from his military records. I got all the letters. I read all the accounts I could. But here's what really, there's two things that really, really made the difference. And the first was, you know, I know it sounds like I'm spoiling the book, but it's pretty obvious from the photographs and so forth that this is the case. The first was, we found his remains after 71 and a half years, where they'd been lost in the sands of Tarawa that long. And those physical remains are the very best gold standard of evidence that you could ever have if you had to introduce it into court. That really, really told us, gave us a lot of information, gave me a lot of information about definitely what didn't happen that day, and also some really powerful information about what seems to have happened. So that was number one. Number two, and this is just, I'm so incredibly fortunate, but this story attracted some media interest, and I wound up getting on TV here and there and in the newspaper. And over the years, from 2010 to 2015, 2016, I was fortunate to be contacted by men who were there, who witnessed what happened that day. And those guys were able to tell me in very, you know, clear, lucid prose everything they saw. And so between everything I had, I was really able to piece it together. And I think I've given a very definitive account. There's still some, you know, little bit of uncertainty about this or that, but basically I think that I've built a really, really powerful case, and I think we know how my grandfather died.
Well, and the silver lining to your grandfather being part of this story, not to use a weird metaphor, but to have that spotlight shined on him brought light to the rest of the band, meaning the other gentlemen who were still lost on that atoll. And so by having that spotlight because of who he was and the things he did and the fact that he was number four of three he was number four along with three others to be awarded the Medal of Honor for their actions on Tarawa, by that spotlight it brought more attention to the whole story, to all the other lost boys who were never brought home. And so, you know, that would be the silver lining to that spotlight.
No, I agree. And listen, it's important to say, and I really mean this, my grandfather, his name was inevitably associated with this because of the four recipients of the Medal of Honor. He was the only one whose ultimate whereabouts were unknown, and so he was officially MIA. We knew he was killed in action, but he was officially MIA. Inevitably, that made him a focus of media, and you know, people talked about him when people doing this work were writing reports to Congress and so forth. They mentioned my grandfather. But ultimately, he was no more or less important than any one of those roughly 1,100 Americans who were killed in that battle. And that includes 400 to 500, we don't know exactly how many, who never came home. Their remains were never found despite the efforts of Army Graves Registration in 1946 through 1950. And so it really was helpful, you know. He was no better. He was no more valuable than Elmer Matthews, who is one of the guys that we recovered in the same trench. And I spoke to a guy who's still living, who was a radio operator, who was right next to Elmer Matthews the day he was killed, you know. And he's no better than Ronald Vosmer, who is a guy who was from Denver. And I went to his funeral, and I got to meet so many of his family members. And all these guys, and I just want to say again, History Flight, Mark Noah's organization, has had incredible success working in this very, very challenging environment. on the tiny, tiny island of Basho in the Tarawa Atoll, recovering these remains. And at this point, more than 100 intact sets of remains that History Flights recovered. And we have teams down there pretty much 365 days a year. Lots of volunteers. These are professionals, archaeologists, surveyors, demolitions experts who want to be part of this. Many of them volunteers and then some paid staff. So we're down there looking for every last one of those guys. And yes, I think it's fair to say thank you to Sandy Bonneman, because your notoriety, my grandfather's notoriety, helped shine a spotlight on the fact that these guys had never been brought home. And now they're being brought home.
But it wasn't an easy journey for Honor Flight either, because... When did they get started down there?
History Flight.
I apologize.
Yeah. Oh, that's okay. It's a real common thing. Honor Flight is a great organization, yep, too. And History Flight, it's a funny name. It doesn't reflect what we do now. But it was started by Mark, who's a pilot, as a World War II warbird organization. And that's what it was started for. And the name just never changed. We don't do that anymore. Mark sold the aircraft to fund this MIA research and recovery. But yeah, Mark and his organization, Mark has raised all this private money. He did all the research. And, you know, every obstacle in the world was thrown up in front of him by, I'm sad to say, mm-hmm, not just the government of the little country where it's called Kiribati, where this island is. And mostly they've been cooperative, but sometimes they weren't. But also, the U.S. Department of Defense has an organization whose job it is to find and repatriate, recover overseas battlefield remains. And honestly, they threw up a lot of obstacles for Mark for many, many years. Now, I want to emphasize, Congress got after those, mm-hmm, organizations. They reorganized them. They spanked them hard. And they are doing much better work because of it. And History Flight has a good, solid working relationship with them now.
Well, and that's the road I was starting to go down without giving away too much details. But Mark, his desire and his passion for this project allowed him to take these hits. Because in the early days, before they had personnel change in these two organizations that we won't get into, they kind of saw him as interference, as someone who's going to, as an outsider, as a civilian, coming in telling them how to do their job. But his research and the amount of work that he put into this, it's like, how can you not look at it? And there were certain points that almost seemed like they intentionally looked at it and then, let's go over here at a couple hundred yards just to kind of make him look bad. But once, as you said, over the years there was personnel change. But when you first got hooked up with this whole idea of going down there to try to recover your grandfather's remains, obviously you didn't know the network down there. And there was one particular gentleman who reached out to you who said, hey, come down here. I can help you find a hotel. I got some people help you with logistics. Unbeknownst to you, he was basically hoping to tie your family name to a project that he was wanting to work on. And once you made it clear that, hey, I'm not coming down here to sponsor anybody's project or endorse anything. I'm just coming down here on behalf of my family to find my grandfather. That person kind of not only took away all the resources he had assigned for you, including the hotel room, but he kind of tried to sour your name as well as Mark's name in History Flight, and that put up a lot of roadblocks during your first trip down there.
Yeah, you know, again, without all those sorted details are in the book, but mm-hmm, without getting into it here on the podcast, I just say, you know, it's not surprising, but it's disappointing that there are an awful lot of people around who they don't want to do the hard work. They don't want to raise the money. They don't want to put in the sweat equity that somebody like Mark Noah decided to do. And what they want to do is piggyback on somebody else's work, or in some cases, try to steal credit for that work. And I'm enraged because it's still happening all these years later. On Memorial Day this year, or just before Memorial Day, the person you're referring to went on a national TV news program, morning show, and lied through his teeth. And
well, it seems to be his MO at this point.
Oh, well,
I know the man, but just from reading the story, well, it just seems like that's kind of how he makes his way through the entertainment world.
Well, it's just disappointing. I mean, he's a particularly egregious example, but he's not the only one.
Yeah.
And I just tell people as often and as loudly as I can, if you want to know who deserves credit for the ongoing recovery of now 100 or more missing U.S. personnel from this battle in 1943 on Tarawa, it's History Flight. History Flight, History Flight, and Mark Noah is the man that made it happen. It is not the U.S. government. It is no other organization. There's no filmmaker. There's no advocate. There's nobody else out there who is responsible for this. And that's just an important message. Again, I continue to be I'm pretty shocked and jaded, but I guess it takes all kinds. And so long as people know and they ask the right questions, they're going to get the answer. And that is, if you want to give the credit, it's History Flight. History Flight, History Flight.
Just a little tease for the book. I just got to ask you, do you miss that pink bicycle?
Oh, my little pink bicycle. You know what? I'll tell you what. People can read the story of the pink bicycle, but Basho, this tiny little island, is less than 1 square kilometer. It's covered with 25,000 poor people, very nice people, but it's dirty. It's not a pleasant place to be. But I'll tell you what, having that bicycle freed me up to get around to everything I needed to see. And yes, it was a pink lady's bicycle.